So, as I said, welcome. And for those of you who are new to these Tuesdays, I should just say a little bit about our overall theme. Our overall theme for this year, in fact, it's about September. Thank you very much. Our overall theme for since September has been what we've called Buddhism through time and space. So we've been looking at how Buddhism has manifested itself in different ages, different cultures, over its 2,500-year history. And we're not doing this, we're definitely not doing this out of any sort of academic interest, okay? We always try and come back to our main point, how can we put Buddhism into practice in this particular time and place? What can the way Buddhism has adapted itself to different cultures and different ages, what can that tell us about how we can practice effectively in this age and this culture? So that's our theme. And just a bit of a recap. So we spent most of the time up until Christmas looking at early, what we might call early Buddhism in India, the fundamentals of the Dharma as taught by the historical Buddha in northern India. And then we moved on since the new year. We've looked at a major new approach to the Dharma that emerged more or less maybe around the time of the birth of Jesus, something like that. Very roughly 500 or so years after the passing of the Buddha. And this was called the Mahayana. And we saw that this wasn't really so much a new approach to the Dharma as a sort of attempt to get back to something closer to the original spirit of the Dharma as taught by the historical Buddha, at a time when maybe in some quarters it had been a bit lost sight of. So it was an attempt to get back to an emphasis on the fact that we don't just practice the Dharma to make ourselves happier, to experience more positive mental states so that we can have a nice time. We also practice to make the world a better place. If you like, we practice to be part of the evolution of consciousness on this planet. We humans, we make a terrible mess. We make a terrible mess of things. And the reason we make a terrible mess of things is because we are deluded. We don't see reality as it is. We have this really narrow perspective where we just see reality as it affects us from behind one pair of eyes. And we see ourselves as the centre of the universe. And because of that, we're always treading on each other's toes. We're always in a sense in conflict with each other, engaged in a sort of battle with each other. And this is our problem. This is our problem. We make a terrible mess of things. So we practice the Dharma not just to become happier. We practice the Dharma to stop being part of that problem and to start being part of the solution to that problem. And we also practice the Dharma to help others. It's not enough just for us individuals to stop being part of that problem. We also practice the Dharma to help others stop being part of that problem and start being part of the solution. So our practice needs to not just be about me becoming more enlightened. It needs to be about us becoming more enlightened, about creating a more enlightened community. And we saw that that attitude was very much there in the Buddha's original teaching. The Buddha used to say to his followers, go forth and practice for the welfare of the many, for the well-being of devas and men, for the well-being of men and higher beings, humans and higher beings. So practice for the welfare of the many. And we've seen over the past few months that we need to have that as part of our attitude to practice as well. We need to learn from that Mahayana perspective. If we're going to get anywhere on the spiritual path, past a certain point, you can get a certain way by just doing it for yourself to become happier. And we usually all start out that way, and that's fine. But to get past a certain point, we have to go past that. Because becoming more enlightened, becoming less deluded, is about breaking out of the cramped little prison of our separate selfhood. It's getting out of that prison we create for ourselves by focusing just on ourselves. And we're not going to break out of that prison of self-obsession if our motivation is still all about our own little selves. We're not going to get away from being only about me if even our practice is all about me. We've got to get away from the idea that, from the motivation it's always about me, even our own spiritual practice being about me. If we don't do that, the motivation for our practice will be at odds with what we're trying to achieve. It'll be like hurrying up to calm down. The motivation will be out of sync with the God. So we need, as the Mahayana emphasized, we need to start seeing the bigger picture. We need to some extent to broaden our concern out to include others and not just ourselves. We need to do that in the way we practice the Dharma. We need to think not just about becoming more enlightened ourselves, although we need to do that, but we need to also think about playing our part in creating a more enlightened community, and being part of that community. So that's what we've spent quite a lot of the last few months looking at, and we've seen that that approach, that more altruistic, other-regarding approach to practice that the Mahayana championed and re-emphasized, is sort of summed up in the idea, the Mahayana ideal of the ideal Buddhist, which is the Bodhisattva. Bodhi means enlightenment or wisdom, and sattva means being, an enlightenment being, a wisdom being. And a bodhisattva is someone who doesn't just practice the Dharma to liberate themselves, but they're very, very consciously practicing the Dharma for the benefit of all beings, to help liberate all beings, not just themselves. So that's what we're looking at. It's a bit of a long summary, so I'm sorry about that. But we talked about, so as I said, we talked about how the Mahayana developed in India, and tonight I'm going to move on to how Buddhism spread into China. I suppose the other big, really big culture that Buddhism had an enormous influence on, how Buddhism manifested itself in China, and what that can tell us about our practice, what it can tell us about how Buddhism might manifest here in our practice. So we saw last week, Surimati told us last week, about how mainly the Theravada style of practice, the pre-Mahayana style of practice, spread south, mainly, into places like Sri Lanka and Thailand and so on, Southeast Asia. And also how mainly the Mahayana style of practice spread north, from northern India into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, Central Asia, and how it then sort of made its way across the Gobi Desert on the Silk Route, following the path of the trade between the west and the east on the Silk Route, through the Gobi Desert, north of the Himalayan Plateau, into China. Seems like a very long way round, but anyway, that's how it mainly did it. And what happened then, what happened when Buddhism went to China, is particularly relevant to us, because when Buddhism went to China for the very first time, it encountered a highly developed culture that was very different from the culture of India, where it had originated. So it encountered this, China was a very, very old and sophisticated society, with its own highly developed arts, literature, its own sophisticated philosophies like Confucianism, its own spiritual traditions like Taoism. And it was a very different culture from the culture of India. I think it would be fair, fair to say it was a culture with a sort of different temperament to the Indian culture. Compared to India, the Chinese seem to have been much more down to earth, much more practical, much less interested in metaphysics, much more interested in making things work at a practical level, less interested in some other world and more interested in this world, less interested in high abstract ideals and much more interested in what in the Dharma is going to work. what's going to work. In fact, they're a bit like us. We too have got a really highly developed culture, with a really highly developed arts and music, which have got a definite spiritual component to them. We've got really sophisticated philosophies, a whole tradition of that. We've got our own spiritual traditions that have developed. And all of that has affected us really deeply. It's really affected the way we think and the way we imagine. We can't ignore it. And it's got benefits. So it's not going to be any good for us to pretend that we're Tibetans or to pretend that we're Japanese. Our culture, as I said, has shaped our thinking and our imagination, and we have to take that into account. We need to use it, in fact, because there's lots of really good stuff in our culture that we can use. And also, like the Chinese, we tend to be pretty practical, I think. Not that hot on metaphysics, but we want things to work, I think. So what happened when Buddhism went to China is important to us. And what happened, first of all, when Buddhism went to China is that for several hundred years, what you got was just Indian Buddhist schools transplanted to China. Just Indian Buddhist schools in China, as they were in India. They didn't take account of this highly developed culture that they were in. They were a bit like alien grafts, bits of one tree grafted onto a different sort of tree. Well, excuse me, I'm going to have lots of horticultural analogies tonight because I'm really into planting things because it's spring. They're a bit like alien grafts, bits of graft, one tree grafted onto another spring, onto another tree. And also, from a Chinese perspective, they were just highly puzzling. They were just really puzzling because there were all these different schools of the Dharma, of Buddhism, that went to China, and they all said different things. They all said, we are the real thing. And they all said, we are proper Buddhism, but they were all a bit different from each other. So you can imagine the Chinese thinking, well, what's going on here? What is going on here? How could it be that there is so much variation between these different schools of Buddhism? If they're all Buddhism, and which one is really the true Dharma? And if one of them is the true Dharma, then the rest must be false Dharma, the rest must be wrong. One of them must be right, and the rest must be wrong. And of course, that also is exactly the situation that there was in the West for a long time. What we got was schools of Buddhism from the East, transplanted lock, stock and barrel, do it this way, you know, you drink Tibetan tea, or you wear a yellow robe, or whatever it is. You do the practice as done where it came from. What we got was various Eastern schools transplanted, and none of those schools took account of our culture or the particular strengths and weaknesses of people in the West necessarily. They were in a way like grafts from a foreign tree, and they were also puzzling because they were puzzlingly different from each other. So, you know, you had Theravada Buddhism, probably the first to come in strength to the West. And then that looked incredibly different from Zen Buddhism, which became very popular subsequently. And then that looked just totally different from the various styles of Tibetan Buddhism. Which is Buddhism? Each seemed to be teaching something a bit different. And each also came along with a hefty dose of the culture of the place where it was, had developed. So it was a bit difficult to separate out what is Buddhism, what's the Dharma, and what's just being Japanese, or being Tibetan, or being Chinese, or whatever. So that's what happened in here, and it's also what happened in China. So it's not surprising, I don't think, that the first school of Buddhism that actually developed in China became really hugely successful, really, really successful for, and very, very influential for a very long time. When something developed that was indigenous, that took the basic Dharma, the fundamental Dharma, but also melded that with Chinese culture, it became hugely successful. And this was a school in Buddhism called Tiantai. Tiantai is named after a mountain, which was the place where the founder of the school lived. So the founder of the school, I say this with great trepidation, is something like Chi Yi, something like that. I don't know how to pronounce that. Anyway, that's how it's spelled. Chi Yi. also spelled Z-H-I-Y-I. I haven't quite got how you're pronouncing these Chinese words. Anyway, so Qi Yi founded the Tian Tai School, and he founded it on his mountain, or on the mountain where he lived, called Tian Tai, so it became called Tian Tai Buddhism. And this happened in the 6th century, so it was quite a long while after Buddhism originally went to China. And Qi Yi made sense, if you like, he made sense of all these apparently different schools, teachings of the Dharma by basing himself on a very early Mahayana text called the White Lotus Sutra. So the White Lotus Sutra was written down, some people say it was written down in the first century before the Christian era, which was about the same time that the Pali Sutras were written down. Maybe some of it maybe was written down later, but it was a very, very early Mahayana sutra. And it became probably the most influential sutra text, Buddhist text, in Japan. Hugely influential in Japan as well. So it's simplifying enormously. What the White Lotus Sutra said is that all the confusing different teachings of Buddhism are what it calls skillful means. They're skillful means. They're all means to an end, okay? And the end is enlightenment. The experience of enlightenment that they lead to, the nature of reality, is beyond words. You can't express that in words. So what these teachings are is ways that you can grow to become the sort of person who perceives that. They are not, the Dharma is not an attempt to describe the nature of things. It is an attempt to give us things that we can do, that we can practice, to become more and more the sort of person who can see the nature of things ourselves. And because we're all different, and because we're all at different stages in our development, we're going to need different teachings at different times. And that does not mean that one approach is right and one approach is wrong. It means that they are aimed at people at different stages of the path, people with different temperaments, people with different strengths, people with different weaknesses, people with different needs. So the Lotus Sutra says, they teach with various reasonings and parables, by analytical arguments and precise terms, by metaphors and analogies, causing them all to make progress joyfully, teaching some through discourses, some through poems, or tales of former times, some by miracles and wonders, some by close reasoning, some by parables and fables, and some by intellectual commentaries. So, in other words, whatever is going to work for that person, the Dharma can take many forms and needs to take many forms to communicate to different types of people and people at different stages on the path. So, in no way is there one right style of practice and all the rest are wrong. So that's, I think, for Qi Yi, that made sense of it. I mean, he also sort of arranged the teachings in a chronological order and said some were at higher levels and lower levels, all of which was, I think the word is hogwash, but his fundamental point was they're skillful means. So in explaining about skillful means and what the meaning of skillful means, the Lotus Sutra harks back to a story from the original Buddhist corpus in Pali, just after the Buddha's enlightenment. The Buddha has had this tremendous realization, but he sits there and he thinks, I simply cannot communicate this. I simply cannot communicate this. This is going to be like teaching dogs to play chess. Yeah? This is not going to work. I cannot communicate. So maybe I just sit here and enjoy the bliss of it all. And then we're told he had a vision. And we're told that in this vision he saw humanity as like a lake of lotuses. So lotuses are tropical water lilies. They grow in the Gange. They grow down in the dirty water, out of the real Gange at the bottom of the lake. And they grow up through the dirty water. And then, so they grow up and up and up, and then they come out as buds. And then they open as the most incredible, immaculate flower. It looks like it's never had anything to do with a speck of dirt. dirt just comes off them. They're just absolutely gorgeous. So we're told that the Buddha had this vision of humanity as a lake of lotuses, and some lotuses were right down there in the Gange still. And some had sort of got a bit out of the Gange, and some were a bit of the way up through the water, and some were up sort of quite a long way through the water where they could begin to sort of perceive the sunlight, if you like. And some had actually come out of the water but were still closed. And the Buddha, the thought came to the Buddha, well, I can't explain the experience of what it's like to open in the sunshine, but I can give teachings that will help those lotuses to grow towards the sunshine. Okay. So what the lotus sutra said, using that image, is that lotuses at different stages of development need different teachings. And really, in many ways, what the Dharma is not an attempt to communicate the nature of reality so much as a horticultural manual on the cultivation of lotuses. In fact, the Lotus Sutra says it's not even just lotuses, because the Lotus Sutra uses this analogy and says, well, we're not even all lotuses. Some of us are trees, and some of us are flowering shrubs, and some of us are bushes and things like that. It uses this analogy, the Dharma rains on us all, and we all grow in different ways. We all grow in different ways. But we all grow. There's always this plant analogy. And using that plant analogy, well, when a plant is young, again, very, very horticultural here, when a plant is young, it needs to develop a healthy root system. Okay? And to give it a healthy root system, you need to use a fertilizer which is high in phosphate, to be technical. And then when it's got that, it needs to develop luxuriant leaves. And to develop luxuriant leaves, it needs a fertilizer which is high in nitrogen. You can take notes if you're thinking of starting. And once it's developed luxuriant leaves, if you want it to bloom and fruit, you need to give it a fertilizer which is high in potassium. And the fertilizers are like different Dharma teachings. And it does not mean that the phosphate fertilizers are right and the others are wrong, or, you know, that's how the Dharma is. We need different teachers at different stages. So we've got to take account of this. We've got to take account of this in our practice. We don't all need exactly the same thing. Okay, we don't all grow in exactly the same way. You can't just have one really sort of standardized path of practice that everybody's going to follow. There are certain practices that are completely fundamental and that everybody's going to need. We all need to develop metta. Without that, no spiritual path. We all need to learn to lead a skillful life. Without that, no spiritual path. But beyond that, we need to take account of our different temperaments, our different interests, our different strengths, our different weaknesses. And we need to gear our path to not just our own level of development, but also to the type of person that we are. We can't afford to ignore one aspect of Dharma practice, but at the same time, we really need to go with what inspires us. We need to put our energy into what inspires us, where our strength lies. If we're more practical, then maybe we're going to make a lot of our practice about what we do in the world. Or if we're more meditative, then if we have a gift for meditation is going to be a really important part of our practice. Not to the exclusion of everything else, but it will be important. We should pursue it. If we're a bit of a thinker, study the Dharma. Study of the Dharma is going to be a really important part of our practice. We all need to study the Dharma, but for some of us that might be a really key aspect. We all need to act, to meditate, to reflect on the Dharma, but the emphasis we give those will vary according to the type of person, the type of lotus we are, the type of plant we are, if you like. And where we're at, or are we particularly artistic? You know, are we particularly artistic? Does art and music give us a way to connect with something higher than ourselves, some way out of our ego? We need to take those things into account. So, the Lotus Sutra, it's a great text, the Lotus Sutra, a bit of a ragbag, but it's a great text. And one of the things it's great for is its parables. And it illustrates how our background and our temperament and so on will influence our practice by using several different parables. So probably the most famous of the parables is the parable of the burning house. And this is so famous, it's so famous in Japanese and Chinese Buddhism, that if you say burning house, everybody knows what you're talking about. All other Buddhists know what you're talking about. So the burning house is our deluded state. The burning house is the mess that we create by our deluded state and the state itself. So if someone in China or Japan wrote, for example, the way to escape the burning house is to do X or Y, everybody would know what they meant because the parable is just so well known and the Lotus Sutra is so well known. So the parable of the burning house tells us that once upon a time, there was this very wealthy elder, this very wealthy father. And he owned a huge, ancient, and very decrepit house. Very decrepit house. In fact, this house isn't so much a house as an ecosystem. So what does it say about this house? It's falling and decayed with lofty halls in a dangerous condition, pillars, bases broken and rotten, beams and roof tree toppling and leaning, foundation in a state of collapse, walls and partitions ruined and cracked, filled with all kinds of refuse, with owls and hawks and vultures, crows and magpies and vipers and scorpions and centipedes and millipedes, geckos, gallyworms, weasels, ferrets, rats and mice. All sorts of evil creatures run about in every direction. There are places stinking with excrement and urine, overflowing with uncleanliness where dung beetles and worms flock together. Foxes, wolves and jackals bite and trample each other and gnaw human carcasses. I could go on. I mean, our house gets untidy, but it's got nothing. It's got absolutely nothing. So, this is the elder's house. This is this sort of horrible ecosystem that's developed over this huge eras of time. And the wealthy father, the paterfamilias of this house, has got this huge numbers of children who are all in this house, and they're all playing with different toys. They're completely oblivious to all the wolves eating the human cadavers and everything. They're completely engrossed in play with their toys. That's bad enough. That's bad enough in itself. But then the house catches fire. The house catches fire. Flames spring up on all sides. And with horror, the father sees that unless I get my children out of this house, they're all going to burn to death. They're in dire danger. Soon the roof is going to collapse and the whole thing is going to be in flames. So he needs to get his children out of the house as soon as he can, but he realises he cannot get them out by force. The only way he's going to get them out is to make them want to get out of the house. They've got to want to get out of the house under their own accord. So he has to offer them something. He thinks, I must offer them something that is even more fascinating than the toys that they're engrossed with. So he shouts out, listen, children, listen, I've got some amazing new toys for you, like you've never seen. Specifically, I've got some amazing carts for you. Presumably these were presumably rich children in India or China used to have carts. They're like, play toys or something, or bicycles, I don't know. Anyway, so we've got all these different sorts of carts. I've got goat carts and deer carts and boat carts. And basically, well, what he's referring to is toys. I've got toys that are better than the toys you've got right now. I've got these really amazing toys for you. So come on out, come on out. They're all outside, just outside the door. Come out and I'll show you these amazing toys I've got for you. So the children will go, yes, and they all rush for the door and they fight to get out. They're all elbowing one another to one side. And then when they get out in safety in the open air, they look around and So the father comes up with, he breathes a huge sigh of relief as his ancient round chapel house collapses in flames. And they all say, where's my deer buggy, where's my bullock cart? And the father gives them all a vehicle such as they could not have imagined in their wildest dreams. He gives them the best car you could possibly imagine. The best toy you could possibly imagine. Something that they couldn't have thought about much better than anything they had in mind when they came outside. And they're all flabbergasted and go, yo, Dad, thank you. That's amazing. So that's a parable, okay? And obviously the burning house represents our usual state, our usual deluded state of mind, our usual approach to life, and the mess it creates. Our old self, our ego, etc. And this is a pretty ramshackle affair, full of nasty bits. And it's very dangerous, and ultimately it's going to catch fire. Unless we get out of it, we're in danger. So the children are us, ordinary folk. And we're all portrayed as being engrossed in meaningless play. Meaningless toys. We're completely obsessed with meaningless toys. Making money, pursuing success, material success, having a good time, having the newest stuff, the newest gadgets, I don't know, watching DVDs. We're all fascinated with it all. And we're completely unaware that this is not a satisfactory situation. This is temporary. The house is on fire and we're in danger. So the father, who you could say represents the Buddha, if you like, or our higher self, knowing that he can't get us out by force, knows that he has to make us want to get out. So what he does is offer us whatever sort of toy catches our imagination, whatever sort of toy is absolutely fascinating for them. Play things that are better and more exciting than what we're playing with at the moment, according to our particular tastes and fantasies. So we get fascinated. We get fascinated by aspects of the Dharma, perhaps. We get fascinated by things that are related to the Dharma. And if we're lucky, we get out of the house. And then when we get out of the house, we find that we don't get what we imagined. We get something better than we imagined, something that we couldn't have imagined. But first of all, we've got to really want to get out of the house. And to want to get out of the house, we've got to be offered something that we really want more than our toys, more than the toys we've got now. You might have seen something like this yourself in your own practice. For example, you might have come along to an introductory course because you wanted a bit of stress relief, perhaps. You wanted a bit of stress relief and you thought meditation would do stress relief. And then you might have found that actually you got far more out of ethics and the idea of a skillful life. That's quite common that people say that, for example. It started out being all about meditation and it became much more about ethics. All sorts of things like that. Over and over again, we get involved because we want one thing, and that takes us part of the way, but then we get something better, actually. But if it wasn't for the thing in the first place, we wouldn't have done it. If it wasn't for what we wanted, we wouldn't have done it. So we practice the Dharma to get something we can imagine and that we want. But over and over again, we get something that is greater than we could have imagined and that we didn't even know we wanted because we didn't even know it existed. So the parable is telling us in a way that whatever it is in the Dharma, whatever it is in Buddhism that fascinates us, whatever catches our imagination, whatever it is we want to get out of it, we should go with that. We need to go with that. We need to let that fascinate us and respond to that fascination. Okay, we may need to move beyond that, but being fascinated by anything in the Dharma is better than not being fascinated and just being sort of neutral, apathetic. To get out of the burning house, we've got to really want something more than we want our toys. We're only going to abandon our playthings if there's something we want more. So we human beings, we're creatures of desire. We're said to live, traditional Buddhism says we live in a karma look at the realm of desire. We're motivated by our desire. We're always trying to move on to a better situation, something better. And we only act when we desire something, or we only act effectively when we desire something. To practice the Dharma effectively, we need to want something. Shock horror. People often say to me, but surely desire is bad in the Dharma. Surely we should be going beyond desire. So I shouldn't say I want something from Buddhism because desire is bad. But so people think that's what the Dharma says. Desire is bad. Well, actually, it's not what the Dharma says. The Dharma does not say that desire is bad. All desire is not bad. If you're thirsty, desire for water is really, really healthy. Desire for healthy food is really, really healthy. Desire for friendship is really, really healthy. Desire for a meaningful life is really, really healthy. What is unhealthy is what Sangharakshita calls neurotic craving. So Sangharakshita defines neurotic craving as desire for something that cannot satisfy the need that it's intended to satisfy. It cannot satisfy the need we feel. So if we're feeling unloved and miserable and bad about ourselves, then eating a lot of junk food to distract us from our unhappiness is not going to help. It's not going to work. It won't make us any more loved. It will just make us more fat. So it's not going to work. And then lots of our desires are like that. In fact, most of the desires, I'd argue that most of the desires that fuel our consumer society are in fact neurotic desires. Neurotic desires are the sort of power that gets that treadmill going. The GDP, that holy thing, the GDP that we're all supposed to bow down to, is just neurotic desire run on overdrive. We don't feel we have a meaningful life, so we go shopping. Or we feel a sense of inner emptiness, so we try to fill it with junk food. Or we don't feel good about ourselves, so we buy an expensive car because the adverts tell us that really good people buy these expensive cars, or the right gadget, or the right clothes. Our base level mental states aren't very pleasant. Our basic experience of ourselves is somewhat unpleasant. So we just try to distract ourselves from that low level of dukkha that we call boredom by TV or internet or beer or whatever. And none of this actually solves the problem. None of this actually solves the problem. All it does is sort of paper over it and put it off for some future time. None of it actually solves the problem. It just makes it worse. So that's neurotic craving. Desire, craving for something that doesn't actually work, that doesn't satisfy the desire that it's meant to satisfy, and just gets us on a treadmill, actually. So neurotic craving for things that don't satisfy our real needs is something we've got to get away from. We need to get away from it. But some of our desires are perfectly healthy. As I said, a lot of our desires are perfectly healthy. And what's particularly healthy is our desire to grow. Actually, our desire to become more than man or woman we could be, the desire to fulfill our potential, the desire to live a meaningful life. Without that desire, we wouldn't practice the Dharma. Without that desire, we would not practice the Dharma. And that sort of desire is called Dharma Chanda. So Chanda is desire. Dharma Chanda is desire for the Dharma. And that's contrasted with Kama Chanda. Is that the right spelling?
Just the
one
without the
one. Not Chanda, Chanda.
Kama Chanda. So Dharma Chanda is contrasting with Kama Chanda. Dharma Chanda is great. Without it, we wouldn't go anywhere. We'd just be stuck on our frozen level. We wouldn't practice the Dharma. Kamachana is sensual desires, desire for things, desire for entertainment, desire, etc. It's not going to get us anywhere. So Kamadhammachana is something that's absolutely central. We need to cultivate Dhammachanda. We've got to cultivate it. So we need to ask ourselves, what is it that fascinates me in the spiritual life? Is it meditation? Is it study? Is it archetypal figures? Is it myth? Is it mantra? Is it the Sangha? Do I yearn to be part of a real community? What is it that fascinates me? What do I want to get out of the spiritual life? And we could try and be honest here. We could try and be honest about what we really want to get out of the spiritual life. So metta is, there's a whole slew of benefits that we're supposed to get from metta, one of which is that it makes us more attractive. So do you want to be more attractive? Well, metta is better than, how much money we spend on being more attractive? Well, metta is better than any cosmetic. And in fact, I know an order member who confessed to me that the reason he practiced for many, many years was that it made him more attractive to women. He said that meditating definitely made him more attractive to women. Well, if that's your motivation, go with it. It'll get you out of the burning house. We want to feel good about ourselves at all sorts of different levels. And if that includes looking good, well, hey, it includes looking good. Do you want to get more of what you've experienced in meditation? Do you want to be free? Can you get a taste in your imagination of what it might be like to experience the freedom of enlightenment? Like that blue sky freedom. Wow. Do you want to be more warm-hearted? Do you want better relationships? Do you want to be part of a real supportive community, the Sangha? Do you want more meaning in your life? Do you want something really worthwhile you can dedicate yourself to? Or do you just want to be a bit calmer, have a bit more peace of mind? Whatever it is, keep it in mind. Keep it in mind. Practice in a way that will lead to it and go for it. You may find you get something even better. But if you don't practice what you really want to get what you want to get, you won't get anywhere. So you've got to remember, what do I want to get out of it? And we could ask ourselves, what is there in the spiritual life that gives me pleasure? What gives me pleasure? We need pleasure. We're creatures. We're driven by pleasure. We need pleasure. We just need to coax it to a higher level. What gives me pleasure? Is it meditation? Is it the friendships that I experience in the Sangha? What is it that gives me pleasure? Is it the increased self-esteem that I experience because of my practice? So, again, we could reflect, well, what have I got out of the spiritual life? What have I gained from practicing? Often we forget to do that. And after a while, we take the changes that have happened in us and the changes we've made, we take them for granted. We kind of remember what we were like before. We forget what a big difference our practice has made. And where we would be if we hadn't come across the Dharma. So I think it's really useful to remember if we were unhappy before we came across the Dharma, if that's why we looked for it, well, we need to remember that. We need to remember that, and we need to remember that the Dharma's helped. If we can see ways that we've changed for the better, or that our life has changed for the better, we need to remember that and reflect on it. And remembering all those things can give us confidence. It gives us confidence. We know that the Dharma works. And if the Dharma worked in the past, it's going to work in the future. It will bring benefits. And this feeds our Dharma channel. Another thing we could do is reflect on how the Dharma has helped us to feel good about ourselves. And all these are sort of in a way related. But how much deep pleasure we get from feeling good about ourselves, and how unpleasant it is not to feel good about ourselves, not to feel that we've got a meaningful life, not to feel that we make a meaningful contribution. Self-metta. We need to feel good about ourselves. We need to have self-metta. And that self-metta can lead on, does lead on, to all sorts of other positive mental states. And I think I'll round off by just calling to mind a sutta from right back from the early teachings of the Buddha that Mogavangsa is particularly keen on. which I think illustrates this. It's a sort of reflection we could do to feed our dhammacanda and to feed our self-metta and to get some pleasure from that. And that's the story of a woman called Visakha. Start to make that up. So Visakha is talking to the Buddha, and she's a wealthy woman. She's a wealthy woman who has made a practice of generosity to the Sangha. And the Buddha questions her, asks her about her practice of generosity. And she says she gives robes, she gives food for visiting wanderers, she gives food for those going on a journey, she gives food for the sick, and she gives medicine for the sick. And the Buddha asks her, what benefits does that bring? What benefits does that bring you? Now, first of all, he says, what benefits does that bring others? What benefits does that bring others? And she says, well, sick monks get better. Monks going on a journey don't starve on the route. And monks that come to the town they could wander around ages for ages not knowing where to get alms food. But I feed them and that gives them a chance to settle in. And so, you know, when a monk comes and they've benefited from my generosity, I feel really good about it. I ask them whether they've been here before and have they ate any of the food for travelling monks or whatever, and when they say they have, I feel great. There's some quite funny things in there as well. She also gives cloths to the bhikkhunis, the nuns, because the bhikkhunis are forced to bathe, it says in the sutta, in the same place of the river as the harlots. And the harlots mock the nuns and say, "Sisters, surely sensual pleasures to be enjoyed. You could become a nun when you're old." And the bhikkhunis are discomforted by this and don't feel right being naked in the presence of the harlots, so she gives them cloths to bathe in. Anyway, nice touch. But basically, she reflects on the benefits that her generosity gives to others. That's the starting point. And then the Buddha says, okay, that's great, you cause benefits to others. What benefits does your practice of generosity give you? And she says, well, I reflect on my acts of generosity. I reflect on the effects they've had on others, other people that I can call to mind. I call to mind actual individuals that I've benefited. And when I do that, I think of the benefits I've brought them, I feel pleasure. I feel glad. And when I feel glad, I feel happy. When my mind is happy, my body feels tranquil. And when my body is tranquil, I feel pleasure. And when I feel pleasure, it's easy for my mind to become concentrated in meditation. And when my mind is concentrated in meditation, I develop my spiritual faculties. I develop my spiritual powers. I develop the factors of enlightenment. And the Buddha says, yo, get great. You know, that's a great way of practicing, basically. He praises Visakha. He says, this will lead to heavenly states. It will quell sorrow and it will bring bliss, this style of practice. He says, basically, that loving merit, if you like, loving positive acts, brings happiness and bliss. And that doing that, Visakha will long rejoice, as he puts it, in the heaven world. So tradition tells us that Visakha did in fact gain insight, that she lived to be 120, that she was highly respected and had given a great deal of authority in the Sangha, including the authority to settle disputes among the nuns. But I think what the story really tells us is about a way that we can develop dhammacanda, a way that we can connect with the benefits that we get from dharma practice. In her case, the practice of generosity, the positive benefits it brings, the self-esteem this brings us, and the pleasure that we get from just feeling good about ourselves, feeling that our life is a positive thing. So you could reflect on that when you do the metta-bhavana. That's a way into the last stage of the metta-bhavana. But sort of returning to the main theme, what the Lotus Sutra tells us is to get out of the house, we've got to want to get out of the house. To get out of the house, we've got to want to get out of the house. And what we imagine we're going to get won't be what we're going to get, because we've got limited imaginations. But hey, we need to go with it anyway, and we'll get something even better. But the main thing is we've got to want to get out of the house. So I think we need to cultivate that dharmachanda. We need to ask ourselves, what do I want to get out of practice? What do I want to get out of my spiritual practice? If that's to look more attractive, well, at least we should be honest about it. What do I want to get out of my practice? I think we can also ask ourselves, what have I got out of my practice? And remember that. And a subsidiary, we could ask ourselves, what are the toys that keep me in the house? What are the things that fascinate me so much I don't want to get out of the house? What are the toys that keep me in the house? Which actually might be a clue to the sort of toys that will attract us out. Yeah. There might be a connection there. So we could think about that, and we could talk about that in our groups, if you like. So we could divide up into some smaller groups. And we could kick those ideas around. What do I want to get out of practice? What have I got out of practice? And what toys keep me in the house? And I think that's something we can sort of extend into our reflections in our practice in general. So let's divide up into some smaller groups.